In the last issue of our series, Dr. Martine Picard-Gebhardt defended the so-called St. Galen approach to adjuvant endocrine therapy in postmenopausal women, in which tamoxifen is used in selected patients for 2 to 3 years initially, and then followed by an aromatase inhibitor. I met with Dr. John Robertson for his take on these and other issues in adjuvant endocrine therapy, and he began by providing an overview of the St. Galen debate.
It's clearly a debate because there's no direct data, so we're discussing your indirect comparisons, and I think it's important to make that statement up front so that we're clear that this is about interpretation of data. But I think that the issues really arise around where did we start, and you know, what has been proposed, and can we see a logical sequence from that? And we've always up to now taken tamoxifen as 5 years as the gold standard. And I think that one important issue to make is that we have got data about 5 years of an AI versus tamoxifen. We've now got two studies of that, which shows that in terms of efficacy, it's clearly more effective overall as a group. There's different side effect profiles. We've got no data on sequencing, by which I mean starting tamoxifen now and changing it 2 to 3 years. And that's different from the switch data. This is about seeing a woman today and saying, I am going to start you off, all my patients, off on tamoxifen and switch them over at 2 to 3 years. The switch data was taking a group of people who'd got to 2 years and for whom there'd been a number of recurrences in that initial population, and the people who were still disease-free 2 to 3 years, switching those over. And so the sequence and the switch are different things.
And, you know, it kind of sounds like splitting fine hairs that really don't mean anything, but I think maybe it does.
Well, I think it does, Neil, in the sense that we all know that in ER-positive disease, 40% of people are hormone unresponsive. And we know, too, that in the adjuvant setting, that there are peaks of recurrences around 2 years. And we know that occurs in both ER-positive and ER-negative. And so it's highly likely, this is my own view on this, it's highly likely that you are seeing a disproportionate number of these ER-positive, hormone-resistant patients recurring in the first 2 years. Therefore, by the time you get to 2 to 3 years, you're left with a more hormone-sensitive group. Therefore, if you've got a new drug which is more efficacious, you will see a bigger hazard ratio or risk reduction in that population than you would in the initial population up front.
When you say hormone resistant, there's also a question of tamoxifen resistant.
I'm using the same hormone in both situations here, so we'll come back to the difference between... What I'm saying is if you look at tamoxifen-treated patients, as I say, there's 40% of people don't respond. And in the adjuvant setting, I suspect that there'd be a disproportionate number of those patients who recur earlier, right? In fact, we did a very interesting study, which we published in Breast Cancer Research and Treatment, which is why I say this. And it's quite complex, so let's just take it through. We took... It was about 1,000 patients in the original series who'd never had adjuvant therapy. So they'd had surgery, radiotherapy, this is the 1970s, early 80s, surgery and radiotherapy, no systemic therapy, and then some of them got recurrence. And there's about 400 of those people. Now, if you plotted the disease-free survival of the patients, all the population, there's no difference in ER-positive and ER-negative patients, right? There's a slight separation of the curve, about 5 years, but it comes back together again in the long term. If you look at overall survival, that is significantly different, and it's different because after they got the recurrence, they were given hormone therapies. So if you take the 400 people now, the subpopulation who got the recurrence, by knowing what happened in metastatic disease, you know whether they were hormone sensitive or not. So you now have two populations of ER-positives and two populations of ER-negatives. You have ER-positive, hormone-sensitive, if you are positive, hormone insensitive, and ER negative, hormone sensitive, obviously a small population, but we know 10% respond, and the big population of ER negative, hormone insensitive patients. Those are the four groups. If you take now those 400 patients on whom you have got hormone sensitive data, and you replot the disease-free survival curve, so they're never having hormones in the disease-free survival, but you know from the future what the hormone sensitivity is. Actually, rather than two curves that overlap each other, ER-positive and ER-negatives, those curves separate out. And the ER-positive, hormone-insensitive group recur earlier than the ER-positive, hormone-responsive group, even though they've not had any hormones. And so it's telling you that those populations, although we call them ER-positive, there's something else about those cancers that make them recur quicker. And that's maybe not surprising why they don't respond to hormone therapy so well.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And so that's the point I'm making about the difference between giving a group of people tamoxifen up front, a switch policy up front, and giving a switch policy at 2 to 3 years. You've taken out a population, a greater population of the ER-positive hormone-insensitive patients. And that's why I think in the data on the switch studies, you see a higher hazard ratio difference, because the AIs are more effective drugs, but they're being given to a group of people who are hormone-sensitive. Therefore, you've got a chance of making a bigger effect.
And so I guess the question is, what's the effect of aromatase inhibitors in those people who recur in the first couple of years? And I guess the answer is it decreases it substantially.
It decreases it substantially too. It probably does have an effect on the HER2-positive type of patient. The other thing to say is, and this is why I think we're talking different types of breast cancer, different subpopulations. I mean, initially when the data came out, you remember you had the ATTAC data, which was an estradiol up front. You had the exemestane data for the switch policy and the letrozole policy for the extended 5 years. And with the upfront, it was a 20% hazard reduction. With the switch, it was 40%. And with the extended, it was 40%. And so people get into this whole question of, was one thing better than the other? The first thing to say is that these drugs, as far as I can see in terms of efficacy, don't really show, at this point in time, huge significant differences. Now, when we get more data, ATTAC and BIG 198, letrozole and anastrozole have very similar hazard ratios. When you look at the switch data, and look at the exemestane study, and look at the anastrozole German-Austrian study and the Italian study, the hazard ratio is very similar. It's about 0.6. And now when you look at the MA17 and the ABCSG6A study, the Austrian study of anastrozole, again, the hazard ratio is very similar. So used in the same situations, these drugs give similar hazard ratios. Used in different situations, they give different hazard ratios. And so the implication must be that you're treating different populations of breast cancer.
That's fascinating. Just to pick up on a couple of things you said, you sort of quickly mentioned that, quote, there's about a 10% response rate to ER-negative tumors. Is that in truly ER0, PR0, or false negative ER you're talking about?
Well, that's always been the question, you know, was the tumor left out in the operating bench just more than the 30 minutes, and so it's gone. The tumour was ER positive, but when you measure it, you just can't measure any. Or secondly, in the past, it was the assay sensitive enough to pick up low levels. I think that's less of an issue now because the immunohistochemistry studies and the enzyme immunoassay studies are really much more sensitive than the ligand binding was. But you do still get a small percentage. I mean, I may revise that down to 5%, but there still is a small percentage of people who have responded to hormone therapies. Now, again, the other slight point of caution, I suppose, is that in the past, when we spoke of this, we really meant they responded to tamoxifen. And tamoxifen's got other modes of action, as you well know. It's, you know, a PKC inhibitor, it inhibits calmodulin. It's not just an estrogen blocker. And so it may be, and this has been some of the hypotheses, it may be that some of the responses or stable diseases in ER-negative patients were through non-steroid pathway actions, mode of actions. But the data has always been that there's somewhere between 5 and 10% of ER-negative patients who responded to tamoxifen. There's not been such big studies of other endocrine agents. Although, again, it was said in the past that megase, patients who are ER-negative could respond to megase and sometimes to high-dose megase. We actually did a study of that. And in fact, at one point, as you know, this dose of megase is 160 milligrams. We took patients up to 1,600 milligrams in ER-negative patients, and we didn't see any real responses in that. So I'm not sure that I would accept that of the progestogens.
So in your clinic then, in the metastatic setting, for example, a patient who's, you know, stable and not in any crisis, do you try hormones in ER-negative patients?
No, not usually. The one exception to that would be elderly, frail people who are not going to tolerate chemotherapy. But no, in ER-negative patients, first-line treatment would be chemotherapy. There may be one or two other situations where you might try that. For example, if somebody has got a supraclavicular fossa lymph node, no other evidence of disease, the question would be, if you try hormone therapy and it works, then the advantage of that is that you've identified as a woman who you should be trying other hormone therapies on for the future. So you open up a whole raft of new treatments to her. But I think those are exceptions, Neil, rather than the rule. And we would not routinely give endocrine therapies to ER-negative patients.
And in terms of non-endocrine mechanisms, are there any speculated non-endocrine mechanisms of AIs?
No, but I think here's an interesting observation, which I made this point at the Miami Breast Cancer Conference. Why do some patients respond to a second AI?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why do they? Or do they?
Well, there is a small percentage. I think it's less than was first thought. When the first reports came out, it was reported around 30% of people get clinical benefit. But in fact, if you look at that data, a lot of the initial studies were with patients who'd had aminoglutethamide as the first AI, which we know is clearly not as potent as the third generation aromatase inhibitors. And now when you're talking about exemestane after a third generation aromatase inhibitor, the clinical benefit rate is now much more down around 20-odd percent. So it's not as frequent as was initially thought. But the fact that happens is an important question, because we all believe that AIs work through reducing estradiol. We know that exemestane doesn't reduce estradiol any more than the other aromatase inhibitors, you know, anastrozole or letrozole. So why, by moving from one AI to another AI, do you get results? And I think the only way for that is that you may well be dealing with other steroid pathways. For example, we know that there are certain differences between the AIs. Some of them have got different effects when you do ACTH testing, for example. And there may be some, you know, mineralocorticoid or androgen effects in some of these AIs. And so I suspect that's as much the maybe the reason why you respond from one AI to another rather than the classical, you know, estrogen-lowering pathway. Because I can't understand, since you've got no difference in your estradiol levels, why should you see a difference in the second responses? And so there must be other pathways.
You have the SOPHIA trial, right? Isn't one of the arms to go to exemestane?
Yeah, that there is comparing exemestane after an AI versus Faslodex. And the real reason for that, I think, is to test this idea. Are you better with a different mechanism of action, an anti-estrogen, you know, blocking drug, as against another drug that simply keeps your estradiol level at the same rate? And I think that will be a fascinating result. In fact, there's two studies. There's the EFFECT study, which we'll report sooner. And the EFFECT study is only testing that question. Post-AI, exemestane versus Faslodex, another AI versus an estrogen blocking drug, and a, you know, pure anti-estrogen. And so that study has finished recruiting and is now in the follow-up phase, and I'm sure we'll report in the foreseeable future. The second study, the SOPHIA study, has got a third arm to it. And the third arm involves Faslodex as well, but it involves continuing the non-steroidal AI that the patient's just progressed on. And the rationale for that is that if you look at cell culture, then if you deplete MCF7 cells of estradiol in the media, you can make that bell-shaped curve that we see when you normally increase estradiol, you see an increase and it drops off when you give high-dose estrogens. You can move that bell-shaped curve to the left so that it becomes much more sensitive to very low levels of estrogen. And what happens then is if you titrate into what's called long-term estrogen-deprived cell line, if you titrate Faslodex into that, you can inhibit the cell line. If you then pick a dose of Faslodex, say 10 to the minus 8, that inhibits that long-term estrogen-deprived cell line, and then you retitrate in estradiol again, then you can compete that out. And so the rationale for this third arm of the SOPHIA study is that when they become resistant to aromatase inhibitors, maybe, nobody knows, but maybe that's because the cells are becoming sensitive to the very low levels of estradiol. And so when you put Faslodex in, yes, you might be able to compete out that estradiol, but if you then stop the AI, you start to raise the dose of estrogen again. And so you get this competition between estradiol and Faslodex because they compete for the receptor on a one-to-one basis. And so the idea is that maybe if you keep the estradiol level down by continuing on this non-steroidal AI, that when you come in with the Faslodex on progression on the AI, you come in there, keep the AI on, that you may have a better blocking effect. Now, it's all cell culture work.
But it makes sense.
It makes sense. And the other thing that may help that hypothesis, it's not exactly the same scenario. The other thing that may help that is Angela Brody's data in the xenograft model, where she gave letrozole in this case, another non-steroidal third generation AI. She gave letrozole or Faslodex or the combination. And she showed that the combination was more effective in controlling those than either alone. Now, that's slightly different from where somebody becomes resistant on an AI and then you come in with Faslodex. But it does still suggest that the combination is important. And I suppose that's also been the rationale for some of the development of Faslodex as well, which is there's, at 250 milligrams, we know it is an effective dose. But the question is, can you make it more effective? And, you know, the two ways potentially to do that would be to increase the dose of Faslodex or to reduce the estradiol level. Or you may even want to try both combinations together in a combined approach. And so I think people are beginning to see that anti-estrogens, in particular Fasolrex, you can't look at it only on its own. It's this combination of how it competes out with the natural estradiol levels.
Is there a reason to think that combining an aromatase inhibitor with fulvestrant would be fundamentally different than combining an aromatase inhibitor with tamoxifen, which we know from the ATTACC trial really didn't work?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that we are talking different drugs, because the thing of the combination in the ATTACC trial is that essentially patients saw the combination as an estrogen. They saw it as tamoxifen because, first of all, the efficacy was the same as tamoxifen and all the side effects were the same as the tamoxifen side effects. You saw hot flushes, you saw the DVTs, all those, you know, vaginal problems. It was regarded as tamoxifen in terms of how the patients responded.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows that, but it clearly was the partial agonist effect that was the predominant effect in terms of side effects and not the estrogen-lowering effect of the aromatase inhibitors.
But why do you say partial? Partial agonist, sure, in terms of the side effects, but also in terms of anti-tumor effects.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the SOFIA trial is going to show?
I hope it shows that we see that improvement in combining the two treatments. I suspect that we may get answers to that before the SOFIA trial comes through, in the sense that metastatic studies often take a bit longer to run, and there are a couple of studies ongoing where they are combining therapies as well, and they may show through sooner.
What trials are those?
There's a study in the US where they're combining Fasolrex and anastrozole versus anastrozole alone, and so we may see whether the combination is better than a single-agent AI. And in some ways, that would be like the same comparison that was made in ATTACC of the combination versus, you know, a single agent. That would be an interesting result.
It's like the Angela Brody thing, then.
Yeah, to see. So that's one. And the other study that we're actually doing in the UK as part of a full centre that I'm the PI on is we're doing a pre-surgical study comparing Fasolrex versus anastrozole versus a combination to extend the previous pre-surgical study we did, which was 50, 125 and 250. We're actually this time using Fasolrex at 500 milligrams versus anastrozole 1 milligram versus the combination. And so what we're doing there really is to see, can we get a bigger effect by increasing the dose? And how does that compare when we both increase the dose and decrease the estradiol level?
When's that going to be ready?
We're recruiting to it just now, and I suspect it will have finished recruiting, hopefully, either end of this year, beginning of next, and so it should be available sometime in 2007, I would have thought.
What about fulvestrant and premenopausal patients? You've seen in the neoadjuvant setting that it doesn't seem to, you know, have the effects you'd expect inside the tumor. What about using ovarian suppression plus fulvestrant in those patients?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the present circumstance, that is, in my view, the really only logical way to use fulvestrant at the present time in a premenopausal setting. I don't think that we have enough information to use it as a single agent. In fact, I think the information we have would suggest that we shouldn't use it as a single agent. So I agree with your comment, you know, can we use it with Caserlin? The data in that is small. There's a small study out of Austria. Günter Steiger has published or presented some data in 15 patients, and they saw about 46% clinical benefit rate. And these were patients who had received it from second to fourth line therapy. So I think that's a very respectable clinical benefit rate for that group of patients, but with the caveat, it's a small number. The other interesting caveat is that they did see responses in the two HER2-positive patients. So again, that's an interesting bit of information. So I think you could use Fasolrex plus Caserlin for premenopausal patients.
Have you done that yourself?
I haven't done it ourselves, no. As I said, his is the only data in the world. What I would say is that I think there's so much data now on Caserlin and tamoxifen, and an increasing body of data on Caserlin and the AI, that I would not suddenly rush to use the new drug in the block and suddenly give everybody Caserlin and Fasolrex. If I was going to do that, I'd use it after Caserlin and the AI or Caserlin and tamoxifen, then I'd come in with it as another sequence.
Well, the combination of tamoxifen and an LHRH agonist is not uncommon in Europe in the adjuvant setting, correct?
Yes.
So if that patient relapses, what would you do?
I'd give them Caserlin and an AI.
So basically continue the AI and substitute...
Continue Caserlin and substitute the AI, yeah.
Right, right.
And then if they progressed in that and were still hormone responsive and you wanted to use another endocrine therapy, then I think you could... It would be off-license, but it would be reasonable to use Caserlin and fulvestrant, I think. if they were hormone sensitive.
Can you talk about Mike Dixon's data that he presented in San Antonio on higher doses of fulvestrant in premenopausal women?
Yes. I mean, it's a really interesting study that he presented. That really followed on from a study that we did 2 or 3 years before that, where we used the currently clinically used dose of 250 milligrams in premenopausal women. And we didn't see any effect on ER, PGR, or Ki-67, the proliferation marker. And that was given for about a 2 to 3 week period pre-surgery, which was the same time as we used it for in the postmenopausal setting. So we saw effects in the postmenopausal setting, but we didn't see effects in the premenopausal at 250. What Mike did was he then gave people a much higher dose, which was 750. And he gave it, I think, a 5 mL injection in both buttocks and one of the muscles in the thigh. And what he showed was, in fact, you did see similar effects in ER, PGR, and Ki-67 in premenopausal women at 750 milligrams as we'd seen in postmenopausal women at 250. And I think that comes back to the discussion we'd been having earlier about this competition between Faslodex and estradiol, that in a premenopausal woman, what you've got is a logarithmically higher level of estradiol. And so to give 250 milligrams, it was not competing out probably with the level of estradiol. And we also have other information on dose. For example, I mentioned before this pre-surgical study in postmenopausal where we'd given them 50, 125 or 250 milligrams. And we saw a dose-dependent reduction in the ER and PGR downregulation. First thing to say is that downregulation never went to zero, even at 250 milligrams. Pick up on it in a second. But it was a dose-dependent reduction. The second thing to say is that in the second-line study of Faslodex versus anastrozole post-tamoxifen failure, that study showed that Faslodex 250 milligrams was as good as anastrozole. And again, I make the point at the beginning so that people who are listening don't get the wrong understanding. Faslodex 250 milligrams in the postmenopausal setting is a good and an effective agent. But that study started off actually not as a two-arm study, but as a three-arm study. And this third arm was 125. And that 125 arm was dropped because it was less effective. And the point I'm making here is that the difference in downregulation of ER that we saw pre-surgery was actually translated into a different clinical efficacy at 125. And so we're seeing something different in Faslodex compared to what we've seen in any other hormone therapy, which is that you're seeing a dose effect potentially. And so the question is, if you go higher than 250 in the postmenopausal setting, would you get a bigger effect? Have we got to the top of that dose response curve? And nobody knows that. So if you're potentially on the upward sweep still on the postmenopausal woman, you can imagine in a premenopausal woman where you get 10 times the higher level of estradiol, that 250 milligrams probably wasn't competing out with the estradiol. And so the 750 that Mike showed us is actually starting to have an effect.
And Mike told me that, I guess, they got 3 injections. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
3 injections, yeah.
Right. And that the patients, according to him, were okay with it. I don't know, have you had any patients get 3 injections?
We've not. We've given them 2 before in the postmenopausal, occasionally for loading, etc. But we haven't. I think the question really would be whether they would be okay with it in the long term, you know, in terms of an adjuvant program. Maybe in advanced disease, patients would accept that. But the question is that any better than giving them a Zoladex injection for a month and making them postmenopausal as to giving them 3 injections?
Or giving them an AI if they're postmenopausal. I mean, I guess the point I'm getting to is, you know, women with metastatic breast cancer are willing to go through toxic chemotherapy for responses, prolongations of responses. You know, a lot of the mm-hmm. chemotherapeutic approaches in the metastatic setting, a lot of, you know, side mm-hmm. effects. I'm a woman like that. Somebody says to me, will you come into clinic and get 3 injections that really don't have any toxicity, but you're going to have 3 mm-hmm. injections in your butt? And I'm like, okay, fine.
Well, I mean, that's possible, but you'd have to do the study to show what the dose response curve in a premenopausal woman is, and that should be done.
How about postmenopausal women?
We need to do that as well. And I mean, I think that's part of the rationale for the development that's going on. And I agree that we don't know the optimal dose. We know a dose that's effective at 250, but we don't know the optimal dose. And I think part of the structure of studies I've been outlining to ongoing are to try and elucidate that. And there's a double strategy here. There's a strategy of increasing dose and a strategy of decreasing estradiol on both of those.
Sure, you know.
But we don't know the right dose.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing
the
is,
optimal dose,
I've been hearing this discussed since the early 1990s.
Absolutely. No.
So, like, you know, it seems like it's going a little bit too slow. I mean, it was almost an obvious question when the drug came out, and it just seems like it's kind of taken a long time to sort of get these answers.
I think it has. I suspect part of the reason for that is that the AI became the dominant focus of endocrine studies. And whether that's because they were perceived to be a tablet and maybe more acceptable to patients.
Better in the adjuvant setting,
yeah, maybe.
Sure.
Also, too, whether it was perceived that there was more competition between three companies and therefore you had to get the drug to market, whereas with Fasoldex, there's no competition in a sense. You can develop more at leisure. I don't know what the issues were, but you're right. It's taken much longer than one would have hoped to see the drug develop.
I mean, the thing that always was striking from day one with the drug was kind of how benign the side effects was. It's actually better than tamoxifen because there was no endometrial cancer and deep vein thrombosis. But even in terms of side effects and toxicity, you know, if you put that aside, I mean, I guess it's kind of hard to say. I mean, do you think, for example, it's comparable or better than tamoxifen in terms of vasomotor symptoms in the same patients?
In the first line study, it was slightly less. The p-value was verging on significance. It was p equal to 0.05. But I've said before publicly, and I state it again, I think Fasoldex is probably the best tolerated endocrine therapy that we have.
Last thing I want to ask you about is I was talking to Eric Weiner and Cliff Huddis, and they're interested in doing a study of delayed fulvestrant, particularly in people who've had AIs in the adjuvant setting. Mm-hmm. That same kind of model as delayed AIs, the way they did it with letrozole.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that kind of strategy?
I think that that's a very reasonable strategy. I think it's almost the reverse of what we've seen, which was using tamoxifen and anti-estrogen, and then after 5 years coming in with an AI. What people are now doing is reversing that sequence, in a sense, using 5 years of an AI, and this time coming in with an anti-estrogen. This time it's a different anti-estrogen, and I do support the concept of it being a pure anti-estrogen rather than tamoxifen. I think it's a great concept. I think one of the questions will be, what should be the control arm? Should it be nothing, as in MA17, placebo? Or should it be an AI continued beyond 5 years?
Or tamoxifen.
So I think those are all discussions to be had as to what the control would be. But I do, and I think the other advantage potentially of that study is that in the first instance, you could probably see that study running for 3 years as a duration. And for injections for women, I think there's been a huge change in that in the last 10, 15 years. Endocrine therapy started, as we know, 110 years ago with Beetson. And to a large extent, over that first 100 years, we thought that all endocrine therapies were the same. It didn't matter whether you give tamoxifen or megase or menagotethamide, it was the side effect profiles. The third generation aromatase inhibitors came in, and now we know that not all endocrine agents are the same. And those studies were only published 10 years ago, 1996 was the first publication. Since then, two fulvestrants come out, and we know now that not all anti-estrogens are the same. That's the second new strand of development in hormone therapy. All the other SERMs that had been done before, tamoxifen, duloxifen, idoxifen, had been exactly the same. They'd never been better than tamoxifen. But suddenly, here we now get another anti-estrogen which is effective after tamoxifen. And the third new strand, as we discussed earlier in our interview, is that with Fasoldex, we do see that there's possibly a dose effect here. And we've always thought of that in terms of chemotherapy or even the signal transduction inhibitors. But we've never really thought about it in terms of endocrine therapy. All the studies previously have really not shown a dose effect. And so there's a number of new concepts coming through in endocrine therapy just in 10 years. So it's a field that's, I think, rapidly changing in terms of the pillars that we used to build our endocrine sequencing and endocrine therapy on. We're seeing a lot of new information coming through, and I think it's an exciting time.